I would like to welcome Michael Starr to Upcoming Discs. He is the director, writer, and producer of Cicada Song, which I got to see recently. And welcome aboard, Michael. How you doing?
I'm great, Gino. How are you?
I'm doing great. Got a chance to see Cicada Song. And I got to tell you, the first impression I have off of it is, gosh, for a limited budget movie, God, it's so ambitious, and I mean in several ways. You've got a relatively large cast for that kind of budget movie. You're trying to touch on a ton of social issues that you're hitting on the movie, and also you're filming it. It looks like you're filming sometimes in L.A. and some of it's in Missouri, so you got like a little cross-country action going on. Did it just barrel out of control, or is that pretty much the heart of what you're trying to do?
That's an excellent question. So we originally, the story began as an environmental piece, which was about the water shortage in California.
Yeah.
Because it hadn't rained here for a couple of years. So, the drought pretty much ended, and it was very specific to where we live.
Right.
But with the new administration coming in, and, you know, they're talking about building a wall and all this other stuff, we were like, well, what if we added an element to it that involved, these upcoming issues that everybody's going to either, support or not support?
Right.
You know, we decided that, we're like, all right, well, we need an environment where both people can cohabitate. So
okay.
We thought about shooting it on a farm. So we had been talking to Lindsay about doing a movie for a couple of years, and we finally decided on this one, and it was in the discussion as we were kind of working out the details of the film. I was like, man, I wish we had a farm. And Lindsay basically was like, I might have one in Missouri. I was like, okay. She's like, my in-laws have a farm. They've lived there for like, the family's lived there for 200 years.
Wow.
And they're very well known in the community. They're very respected. And I said, well, if they're agreeable, I would love to shoot it in Missouri because I think it's a great place to set the film.
Sure.
Better than California on some levels.
Mm-hmm.
Farms are so vast there. So she talked to them and they agreed to do it. The barter for us was I had to go and shoot their son's wedding.
Ah. Okay.
So I was a photographer for many years, and I said, I will do the wedding in, place of payment. I will do it in barter for, letting us shoot for a couple of weeks here.
Good for you.
Absolutely, no problem. So it took, a few months to get everything together,
mm-hmm.
and then we scouted in Missouri, and the whole time, Tom Bellows, producer who lives out in St. Louis, and I were scouting. I kept saying to Tom, I was like, man, how are we going to make this movie on this budget?
Right.
And he's like, I don't know, man, but So we got out there, and Lindsay's brother-in-law, Jim, basically started knocking on people's doors, and we were with him. He's like,
wow.
Hey, these guys want to make a movie on your property, in your house, in your bar. And they're like, go ahead, guys, sell your story. Sure enough, we had, in the week that we were there, locked in 7 locations.
Okay.
And did local casting for some of the people that were going to be in the film.
Right.
And, driving back on the final day, I said to Tom, how could we not do this movie? So, from that moment, we had 1 month to raise enough money to cover our expenses to go to Missouri, and it was actually cheaper for us to shoot that film in Missouri than it would have been to shoot it in Los Angeles or California. So, we flew all our cast and crew and from L.A. and New York, and we were there for 12, 13, 14, about 15 days.
Wow.
And we shot everything that we could shoot in Missouri, and then we went back to L.A. for a few days and wrapped up in Los Angeles.
That's incredible.
So it was very much under control. We knew exactly what we were doing the whole time because it could get out of control. But we had a very tight crew. We had a very tight understanding of what we needed. The script was very lean, and the actors also knew, you know, how important it was that we get our rehearsals in before
right.
we start, making sure everything worked. So yeah, it was very much under control. It was just one of those things that, you know, we weren't sure if we were going to lose control.
Right.
Maintain.
Well, and that leads me perfectly into my next question, actually. And that is, you're both the writer and the director. So sometimes I wonder, when you're directing a film as the writer, it gives you a little more control over the story. And so my big question is, during the shooting of the film, did the story change, or did you stick pretty strictly to the script that you had written before production?
Well, that's interesting, because I learned my directing style from Barnett Kelman, who was director of Murphy Brown and
yeah.
Mad About You, and you know, I went to USC to learn filmmaking, and he was
yeah.
my mentor. I was his assistant.
Great.
And what I learned as a writer, director,
mm-hmm.
is you need to release the control to your actors and
okay.
work with them as a collaborative.
Yeah.
So I'm a very collaborative director in that sense, where the way that I hear it in my head is not
mm-hmm.
necessarily how they hear it or say it
sure.
or work it. And, you know, unless it absolutely needs to be, you know, this way, most of the time there's a lot of freedom that I give them, because their interpretation is usually better than mine. You know, what
yeah.
I write for them to say, their interpretations just bring life
yeah.
to the words that I write. So I just felt like letting go of that control.
Right.
Opposite, because budget and scheduling needs to be in control, but when you're letting the actors play and find those moments, you know, it was more important for me for them to have control over their characters and what they were going to do. And I'm not saying that I gave up the control.
No, I understand what you mean.
Still had to have a little bit of understanding of where the scene was going and leading into the next from the previous.
Right.
But, you know, it really is a collaborative medium. You can't do it alone.
Right. But I mean, even from your standpoint, because now you wrote it from the idea of a writer, and then as a director, you're looking at the story from a somewhat different angle. So did your interpretation of the story change as you went along, looking at it from your director's position rather than the writer's position?
Yes. Well, a couple of things had to change.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, a location.
Right.
No control over that, because the scene with Tom Wilkes and Bob in front of the combine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the combine was not in the place that it was supposed to be originally. It was moved. So we had to caravan about 7 miles to a new location that we hadn't scouted.
Mm-hmm.
And were very concerned
sure.
about the location, because we'd never seen it. So
right.
as we're coming over the hill, for the first time, this farm sprawls open. And there's cornfields
yeah.
that haven't been harvested yet.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big white house. There's four barns that we can choose from to shoot in front of.
Wow.
And we just kind of looked at the situation, and we were like, this film wants to get made.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that happened after that, you know, we ran into a problem.
Yeah.
Usually a solution presented itself right away, and we
sure.
started calling it the combine syndrome.
Right.
And, you know, having that part of the story change, when you have one place you're going to shoot, and that place is not where you're going to shoot, you're going to shoot somewhere else.
Right.
You kind of get a little nervous.
Yeah.
But, you know, you trust in the fact that whatever is there, you're going to make the best of
it. To make the best of it,
so,
sure.
Yeah. But the story itself did not change.
Okay.
Except for the ending.
Okay, and we don't want to give away the ending, of course, because we want people to watch the film. So we don't give away any of the ending. But now, when you were talking about Lindsay, you're, of course, talking about Lindsay. Am I pronouncing it right, Lance?
That's correct.
as her last name. She plays Karen, who's a central actress or the central character in the movie. And we get to see her kind of almost in two time periods. It's not necessarily linear. We get to watch her investigating. She's investigating a missing friend and also that ties into a missing youngster. And then we see her several times throughout the film almost having coherency problems. She's obviously somewhere where she's disoriented. She's trying to escape something. So we get to watch that as well. And when you film those kind of parts, did you get the opportunity to be able to film those where all the you know, Wood stuff was at one time and then her other stuff was another time? Or did she have to go back and forth between those two, I guess you'd call them time periods?
Well, no, we shot everything as one continuous day. So,
okay.
There's obviously when you're making a film, everything is kind of shot out of sequence.
Right.
Sometimes, you shoot what you can with the location that you have.
Absolutely.
Luckily, we were staying at a sleepaway camp.
Oh.
Most of the crew was housed at a sleepaway camp in New Haven, Missouri. Camp Trinity.
Okay.
And right outside the parking lot was this vast sprawl of woods that we could just go in.
Right.
And point the camera in any direction, and you couldn't see anything except woods. So we were lucky enough to say, okay, well, we don't need to move too far from where we need to go. We can just kind of set the camera up in a 360-degree circle.
Right.
And it'll look different every time.
Right.
So we ended up, staying very close. Everything was shot very tight. But, yeah, Lindsay, we progressed her makeup as the day went further. So we started off, doing what we needed to do with the actors that we had on that day.
Right.
So that took about 2 days to shoot.
Okay.
Because we had, one section of that was her by herself, and then we had some other sections that had other people involved.
Right.
And, not everybody's there on the same day, so yeah, we did have to match her makeup at some point, but it did take a couple of days to shoot the wood.
Mm-hmm.
It was done pretty much consecutively.
Yeah, the reason why I asked that is because I assume that the actress really had to be in two different headspaces, and it might have been difficult to have to go back and forth to them, because they're really, even though it's the same person, it's the same character, they're really two different people at these two points in times, and the actress does a great job of letting us see that. You see with her through the woods the wear and tear of all the stuff that we're going to get to see that preceded it, and that may have been difficult if you had to go back and forth.
Casting is essential.
Yeah.
And I've worked with Lindsay in the past, and there's never been a moment where I felt she couldn't handle what I threw at her. As a matter of fact, part of our discussion was, me asking her what kind of film she wanted to do.
Right.
And the first words out of her mouth was survival film. And I said, well, how gritty do you want to get? She goes, the grittier the better. So, basically, I didn't write a scene in that film without walking it past her first.
Right.
And say, are you okay with this? Are you okay with this? Are you okay with this? And everything, she's like, yep, no problem. Great, you want me to do that? Awesome. Can do. And, she also was a contributor to the story.
Mm-hmm.
So she knew what she was getting into from day one.
Yeah.
So, everything that she does as an actress, her choices
mm-hmm.
are based on our discussions previously.
Right.
But there's nothing in her that says stop.
And right.
Right now, Lindsay has gone on to be a Los Angeles firefighter.
Wow, you're kidding. That's amazing.
She's a professional firefighter right now.
That's amazing.
She's got her shield. She's officially part of the gang.
Wow.
And she's saving lives.
Well, that's fantastic. That really is. And you could tell from the movie that she's all in. I mean, that's, quite honestly, if she hadn't been, there goes your movie.
Yeah. And that's the other thing, everything happened for a reason.
Yeah.
She came in and, just in almost every scene.
Yeah.
You know, I think maybe three or four scenes that she's not in, but, you know, you can see how she kind of brings out the performances in other people.
Yeah.
As well. You know, she's so engrossed in her character. And then, you know, once I call cut, she's, you know, totally a different person. It's just a lot of fun to be around. And she just takes it very seriously. And that's what I love about her.
Well, that's great. Now, you're doing a limited budget film. Of course, now you have this across the country thing, so you have some of these other expenses to worry about. Is there anything that was originally intended for this film that you had to leave out just strictly because you didn't have the budget for it? Something you wished that had been there?
Well, you know, here's what's really interesting is that we're a mystery thriller, you know.
Uh-huh.
There's usually a courtroom or some kind of, you know, situation that, or maybe not, but point being is we wanted a courtroom, and the courtroom was written in to the script originally,
yeah.
And we just couldn't afford it.
Just couldn't afford to do it. So yeah. You leave it with the arrest at the end, which I believe there's a cameo in those arrests among the officers. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Talking about mine?
Yeah, you're one of the cops at the end, right?
Actually, you can't see my face. And again,
okay.
You know, I Hitchcocked it in some way.
Right.
That it's, you know, I'm not so much an arresting officer as I am more of an officer just walking towards someone.
So you don't get to actually cuff and stuff anybody.
It's me and the producer, Tom, who also makes a few cameos as a police officer. It's pretty, you know, you're talking about low budget here. You know, you got to do what you got to do, but the big thing is, you know, we're not wearing riot gear. We're not, you know, but we can, you know, it's a movie.
Right.
So you can have fun.
That's the big climax, so, you know, have some fun with it.
Yeah.
Now, also, you're a musician, and there's a ton of good music in the film. I was quite impressed with not only the amount of music, but with the variety of music that the film sports. And looking at the credits of all the music that was there, notice one of those is yours. You composed one of the pieces there. Can you tell us about that? And also tell me about how you used music in this film, because it's a very important part of this film.
Yeah, well, music is an important part of my life, Gino.
Yeah.
I grew up, you know, playing the cello, and I then learned the drums, and was, you know, I played some music in my day.
Sure.
And went on to produce a record on my own because, you know, as a drummer, people don't think of you as a musician.
You know, that's true. I have a band, and we've often said that, you know, what's a guy surrounded by four musicians? Drummer. But I'll tell you what, I do have a lot of respect for drummers, because there's nobody who works harder.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. But we, you know, we couldn't find the right song. I didn't plan on putting my own music in, because, you know, I also, you know, I wrote the film, I directed it, I produced it with, you know, my other producers.
Right.
And, you know, my name's all over this thing, and I'm not, I don't want to be that, you know, that guy. I mean,
right.
You have to give yourself those credits when you do those things.
Right.
But, you know, the friends that I, you know, met along the way that are musicians,
mm-hmm.
Rusty Tinder, Jim Bakke, Susie Glaze, Ernest Troost, you know, Alex Williamson, who did the amazing score for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people I've known for quite a while now.
Right.
And I've always wanted to make a movie where I put my friend's music in the film. But not only is it just my friend's music, it's really good music.
Yes, it is.
It's not like, you know, oh, my buddy recorded this in his bathroom. No, these are professional musicians that have careers in the music business that contributed their songs to our film, you know, because they wanted to contribute
right.
The film, you know, to the film.
Sure.
My song just happened to be one of those right. things. It was like, all right, this is the you know, you're on a limited budget. You can't really pay $400-$500 for, you know, a song that, you know, you just can't.
Right.
So I have a record, I put my own song in. But what's more important to me is everybody else's music and how they enhance the energy of the film, because, you know, the songs get darker as the film goes on, as does the way that the film was graded. So, you know, we talk about color and music and how the film progresses, you know, the
exactly.
film starts in full color and progresses into this, you know, degresses actually.
Sure.
Into this bleached look, and then, you know, stuff, the survival stuff goes in behind.
Yeah.
It goes from bleach to color.
Right.
So there's a point in the story where they mix, and the music enhances that as well.
Sure.
But when you're living day-to-day stuff, and you hear stuff on the radio, and, you know, most of that stuff's going to be joyful, or, you know, it's going to set the tone or
right.
the mood. And I don't like to use things that are on the nose, but the song's perfect for the moment that we set up. So I'm actually quite proud of that, and especially, you know, the soldier at the end of the, it's the credit roll,
right.
that song, The Soldier by Dizzy Glaze, and
no, it's excellent. It really is excellent, and you have to admit, for low budget films, there aren't usually that many musical contributors. There just aren't.
It was a blessing. I mean, we had so many guests on this film, Gino. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, and the last thing I really wanted to ask about with the film is editing. Because I get the impression as I'm watching these interspersed moments of her wandering through the woods that eventually we'll get that story told to us. And they seem to, in the beginning, almost be like teasers to how did all this happen. How it must have been very difficult. You're almost rewriting the film when you're finding out where to edit those. How did you decide when those spots fit in, when it was time to put one of these in, and how long, and what exactly you would put in there? That to me seemed the most interesting of the editing process.
Well, Jen Bell and Mike Blum and myself, so once we had finished the film, you know, we gave all the footage to Mike to encode, and he gave it to Jen, and Jen started cutting right away.
Right.
You know, we had like a 90-minute cut, and it just wasn't working.
Okay.
So, you know, there was the way that the first few scenes were written were very consecutive.
Okay.
And so the whole opening section of that was, you know, about two or three pages of consecutive, like, survival. And then, you know, Jen and Mike had kind of talked about it, and they're like, you know, I think we should kind of break this up a little bit.
Yeah.
And I kind of agreed with them. I said, you know, I mean, well, let me see what we're talking about here. So we can hear more and more throughout the film, kind of like the way that, you know, Adrian Lyne's Jacob's Ladder
right.
Teased back in the day where, you know, if you haven't seen that movie, that's one to watch for your audience. The way that they kind of tease you into looking at, you know, the point of view.
Right.
And the way, that's kind of the way I felt it was kind of in line with was, you know, we're not necessarily teasing them. We're moving two stories along at the same pace. One's
yes.
a lot shorter because it's, you know, little pieces here and there.
Right.
But they need to end up at the same point, at the same moment that the film's going to have its emotional climax.
Right.
So they interspersed it throughout film, giving it more of a break in between sequences. So, you know, most of the sequences begin with, you know, the wood shots, and they then, you know, move back into that other timeline. So
right.
You have these parallel timelines that crisscross in the final moments of the film.
So that's something that actually got put together sort of in post-production, because you didn't necessarily have an intent as to where you're going to sparse them out. Was there a point where that was just all going to be one scene, maybe towards the end of the film?
Well, there was, originally, it was written as interspaced, so I just didn't do as many in the script.
Ah, I see.
They had the basis of, you know, what I was looking for, but I didn't necessarily see as much of the interstitial.
Yeah.
I want to call it the connective tissue. So, you know, I had written these little bumps.
Right.
Of her surviving.
Right.
They stretched it to the point of bringing us back to that moment of, you know, what's happening. Okay,
yeah.
So we're moving along this story. Now we need to go here. And what they did was kind of, you know, get into it up a little bit more. They chopped it up a little bit more and gave it more body than it was originally in the script. So it's kind of like, you know, the whole ending montage of The Godfather.
Yeah.
There in the script.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they ended up cutting it. There were probably a couple of things that were there, but they made it bigger.
Right.
Better.
Now, I get that, and to get back to musicals themes again, it's your beats. I mean, it seemed to me as I was watching it, you were setting your beats, you were setting your moments with that, you know, that's going back to the footage of her in the woods. It seemed to me like you were making a point of, okay, here's where this is happening. Now we're, you know, we're punctuating a point of the story this way, and to me it made it more effective.
Well, I appreciate that. It is exactly, you know, he's exactly right. Again, it goes back to trusting your actors.
Yeah.
With the words that you give them, you need to trust your editor.
Yeah.
The footage you're giving them.
Absolutely.
You give them what you have, and then they cut it to the script, and they're like, you know what, this is not working as well as it works on the page.
Yeah.
We need to fix a couple of things here and there. We need to tweak this. We need to tweak that. And before you know it, you know, we have a 73-minute film that is tight. And, you know...
And it moves.
It's a good song.
Yeah. So now tell our audience exactly how they can get a hold of this film, where they can watch it, where they can purchase it. Tell us how people can get a hold of this and give it a try.
So we're on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
We're on Apple TV.
Mm-hmm.
And we are on Google Play. And currently we're on transactional.
Yeah.
So it is a rental, or you can buy the film.
Okay.
We will be... promoting a DVD pretty soon.
Okay.
I believe Blu-ray is in the works too, but I'm cutting an extras package for that, so we're going to have
nice
your usual stuff, you know, on a DVD.
Right. And when will we see that about, approximately?
I'm hoping it'll be March.
Okay.
I'm hoping. You know, I mean, I got to talk to IndieWrite, our distributor, about making sure that all the information that I give them is proper.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Deliverables is a big thing.
Yeah.
So we have to really kind of make sure that we deliver the proper file, make sure everything is right. But if everything goes right, then I would say probably March. And if it does go through in March, it'll be on demand shipping. So we don't pre-press it.
Sure. Right.
Which is amazing to me. Back in the day, you had to press 500 copies. And,
minimal.
Yeah. Now it's everything's on demand.
Yeah. Well, that's very good news, and I'll be looking forward to seeing when the DVD and possibly even the Blu-ray come out, and we'll certainly talk about that, and we'll make sure to put some links to the film and stuff on this post so people can find their way to your movie. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about Cicada Song, and I hope people go out there and take a look at it. It's definitely not what I would expect from a limited-budget film. You do things that most people can't or don't do in a limited-budget film, and you should be congratulated for that, and I appreciate you taking the time to share it with us.
Gino, it is my pleasure to be on your show, and I really hope that your audience enjoyed the film as much as you did.
I
really appreciate the time.
I think they will.